Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, and once again we have with us on the show today Dr. Steve Fuller, Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. Dr. Fuller has written a few books that deal with the debate over intelligent design and evolution. His latest one is called Descent Over Dissent. And Dr. Fuller, you're here with us on the phone today, and I really appreciate you coming back on the show with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
So why did you write your new book, Descent Over Dissent?
Well, I guess the main reason is I wanted to sort of put some provocative theses on the table that relate to the intelligent design Darwinism controversy, and to a certain extent, keeping in mind that we're about to get to the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birthday and the 150th anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species next year. The arguments that I make in the book have to do with, first of all, whether there is something like a scientific consensus that exists around evolutionary theory. I mean, what's the evidence for that, if there is any such evidence? And also, whether one, you know, in what sense would Darwin be considered a scientist today? I mean, is he really a scientist? And does the history of biology since Darwin's day, as it were, move in the direction that Darwin himself was moving when he was doing natural history? And then the most of the rest of the book has to do with basically showing how, if you want to understand the history of biology, the intelligent design perspective is actually very helpful, especially in terms of genetics and molecular biology and recent developments in biotechnology.
Mm. Neil, I want to just ask you some questions about some of the interesting points you make in your book, and I found many of the points you made in your first chapter very interesting. Is there a scientific consensus, Dr. Fuller, and if so, does it matter?
Well, we don't know if there's a scientific consensus, because in fact the way in which science is represented is not democratically. Okay, so if you look at things like the Royal Society and the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, and this is quite true of scientific associations throughout the world, they are basically self-organizing, self-constituting bodies. So you basically get invited to join. But nevertheless, they are the bodies that are said to represent science. And the people who belong to these things are very distinguished scientists and so forth, but we have no idea whether they represent what most scientists, you know, who work in sort of lowly jobs or science teachers or something like that, what they think. And so it's actually very difficult. I mean, the problem is, of course, that the scientific associations talk in terms of a scientific consensus, right? And so,
yes.
You know, and that's the big problem. I mean, in a sense, it wouldn't matter so much if they didn't, as it were, justify their views, you know, saying, you know, evolution is the only proper explanation in biology. You know, it wouldn't matter that they hold such views, except that they say there's a scientific consensus around it. And so if there's a scientific consensus, it's reasonable to ask, well, do most scientists believe it? Okay, because that's normally what we mean by consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And the short answer is we don't know. And there seems to be no interest in finding out.
One of the points that I have observed is that when scientific bodies will issue their ritual condemnations of intelligent design, those statements are issued by small committees composed of just a few people. And while they may represent the views of the people on that committee, who were probably picked for that committee for a certain purpose and because of their views, there are always people, members of those scientific societies, who do not agree with what that committee has had to say. And I can think of many instances of people who are members of scientific societies that have condemned ID, and yet I know members who completely disagreed with what they said. And so this whole notion that, you know, a committee that was self-selected can speak for all scientists really just is quite illogical, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think you have a point there. I mean, one of the things that's quite interesting is that the more people you put on such committees, the vaguer and more watered down the statement of agreement is. So, for example, there was this document that was this inter-academy document on the teaching of evolution that came out about 2 years ago now, where basically 67 national academies of science around the world, you know, agreed that, you know, evolution is science and creationism is not. Now, you look at the fine print of this document, so you have these 67 national academies agreeing to it. Well, the phrase natural selection doesn't even appear in the definition of evolution that all these people endorsed, all these different academies endorsed. And with regard to creationism, what's explicit, the only thing that's explicitly ruled out is young earth creationism. Mm. And my guess is the reason why a document of that sort that is meant to be some kind of, quote, scientific consensus at a global level, right, that's about as good as they could get.
Very interesting.
Right, so this is, we're talking about the elites of 67 countries, that's all they could agree on.
Very, very interesting. Wow. Let me ask you this question. People often argue that ID is, quote, anti-science. And there's a point in your book where you sort of make a contrast between anti-science or anti-establishment. And it's possible that you're suggesting that when people say that ID is anti-science, what they really should be saying is that ID is anti-establishment. Could you elaborate on that point?
Yes. I think because one of the things that when we talk about doing science, we often kind of conflate two things. On the one hand, there's this issue about whether you proceed by the scientific method, whether you test your theories, whether you reason logically, whether you kind of weigh the evidence in some kind of appropriate way, and so forth. But then there's this other sense of being scientific, which is the idea that you believe in the right kinds of explanations. In other words, that you put your data together in the right way. Okay? Those are two quite different ideas, and very often when one calls a theory like intelligent design anti-science, the reason why it's being called anti-science isn't because it isn't using the scientific method or something like that, but rather because the kinds of explanations that it uses aren't the orthodox ones.
Mm.
Right? So, for example, you know, if you think about something like Dembski with the idea of these explanatory filter things, right, where design becomes a distinct form of explanation independent of chance and necessity. Well, that already kind of violates the orthodoxy, right, at least in terms of neo-Darwinism, where anything that happens in nature is going to be some combination of chance and necessity in some
way. Sure.
Right, and so here's Dembski saying, well, no, there's this other kind of general explanatory principle called design. And see, when he posits that, people start saying, well, that's anti-scientific. Well, no, what he's doing is he's introducing a new explanatory principle that ends up causing us to look at the same old data in a different way.
That makes a lot of sense. So do these new scientific modes of explanation or these new theories, are they required to come up with completely new research, or can they draw upon pre-existing research in making their case?
Well, that's the thing. Yes, they have to draw on pre-existing research. And I think one of the rhetorical difficulties that intelligent design faces in its conflicts with evolution is that there's this presumption that intelligent design theory has to generate all its own data, as if it could not re-explain stuff that other people came up with. Okay? Because if you expect a new scientific competitor to have to generate all of its own data, right, then you're never going to get a competitor going. And in fact, in the history of science, right, what happens is not just that a new scientific theory generates new data, but it causes you to see all the old data in a radically new way. Mm. I mean, that's what a scientific revolution is typically about, right? Sure, there's a certain amount of new data, but mostly what happens is a reinterpretation of the old data. And look, I think a great example of that in practice is what, in fact, neo-Darwinism did. Because if you look at who exactly came up with the various discoveries and so forth, for example, in genetics, you'll find a lot of Christians there, right? But you never know it, right? Because, as it were, the data gets reinterpreted in light of this framework that has no kind of theological backstory at all. And that's very common in the history of science. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But what it means is that you have to reinterpret large bodies of data that were, in fact, discovered by people who operated with different assumptions from you.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, another example besides neo-Darwinism would be Darwin's original theory, which, of course, Darwin's Origin of Species was basically a long treatise that reinterpreted pre-existing data.
Well, that's right. Yes, indeed. I mean, and some of it, you know, in fact, even, reinterpreting Paley, you know, the natural theologian, right? I mean, so that's right. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that does need to be done. And I do think, to a certain extent, that is something ID needs to do more of, because I think what ID is very good at doing is showing gaps in neo-Darwinian explanations. I think it's very good at doing that. But the thing that is that maybe needs to be made more clear is actually what is the cognitive payoff? What is it that you are able to see by postulating design that you could not see otherwise. But that doesn't mean coming up with radically new data. That means taking the data we already have and reinterpreting it.
Sure, sure. Now, one of the my more enjoyable parts that I really enjoyed in your book was when you take Ken Miller to task for claiming that an experiment that evolved a new protein-protein binding site refuted ID. Can you tell us what you said about Ken Miller's commentary on that experiment and whether you think it actually refutes ID?
Well, I mean, the thing about these experiments that Miller refers to, you know, in his book, Finding Darwin's God, which in a way has the most extended kind of discussion of the kind of evidence and argument that he used in the Kitzmiller case against Behe, that what he ends up presenting as the counter argument are these highly artificial, you know, which as experiments are necessarily intelligently designed situations, which end up bringing about the kinds of results that he's talking about. And you know, you can set up an experimental design that enables you to generate mutations, and these mutations end up kind of doing the thing that they're supposed to do. And you say, look, I've shown that Darwinian processes can produce something that Behe thinks is intelligently designed. Well, hell, the thing, the experiment that you've done is incredibly intelligently designed. Right? The experiment does not set itself up. Okay, I mean, the experiment involves a lot of forethought, a lot of front loading with regard to how you have to set up the lab, how you have to set up the conditions, and so forth. And then the question that arises from looking at something like Miller's experiment is, what reason do we have to think that something that was so well crafted, so intelligently designed, right, in the laboratory, is just happening in nature spontaneously all the time? I mean, he doesn't give you an answer to that question. He just assumes it. And this, I think, is quite characteristic of the way in which a lot of these neo-Darwinists argue. They have these very beautiful experiments that actually, in a way, you know, demonstrate natural selection in a very artificial fashion. And then the question is, well, does natural selection happen naturally? We know it happens artificially when it's intelligently designed, but does it happen naturally when there's no experimenter around?
And that would be the core question that we need to address in the debate.
I would have thought so. No, yeah. I would have thought so. I mean, but it is very characteristic of the sort of neo-Darwinian perspective that they move very easily between radically different kinds of methods for doing science. So there's stuff, you know, they'll take evidence from the fossil record, evidence from living animals in the field, and an evidence from a lab experiment, and they'll treat them all as pretty much the same. Whereas, in fact, there's, you know, there, as it were, things can be gained and lost in the translation between the different methods.
Let me ask you a final question here. What do you think is in store for the future of intelligent design?
Well, I actually do think that it's going to become a more prominent position, largely because, and again, this is an area where I think intelligent design doesn't really talk enough about. But if you look at where biology is going at the moment, we are moving in directions where, you know, it's pretty hard to deny intelligent design is going on. So if you look at the way we're investigating the human genome, the sorts of medicines that we're able to come up on the basis of it, a lot of the very controversial work having to do with bioengineering and biotechnology, none of that stuff, right, would be possible if the genome was not intelligently designed. Okay. In other words, we're treating biology more and more as a technology, as an engineering project. And the more we kind of move in that direction, the harder it is to deny that that life is intelligently designed. I mean, because after all, we're trying to intelligently design it, and you know, we're not the first ones to do it, right? There's obviously some prior cause.
I completely agree with you, and I think that as science deals more and more with the information biology and trying to understand the complexity of the cell, that ID will prove to be a more and more fruitful paradigm, to use a word that you don't like, in doing that kind of research. But Dr. Fuller, it's been wonderful interviewing you and having you on our show. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Go check out Dr. Fuller's book, Descent Over Dissent. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.